As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This is the Game Football Podcast from The Times. Today, Manchester City turned the Premier League title race into a procession. What next for Everton after the sacking of Rafa Benitez? We'll talk about postponements in the Premier League. Do we need more transparency? And we catch up with an old friend in the shape of our very own Matt Dickinson. This is The Game. Welcome back. I'm Hugh Wisencroft alongside Alison Rudd, Tom Clark, and the lesser spotted Matt Dickinson. Matt, how are you?
I'm great, Hugh. It's great to be back. Thanks for inviting me. Yeah, I'm still the same person. Still got no hair. Still talking nonsense. glad to be on my return.
We will come to what you've been up to a little bit later on in the podcast, including playing Dickinson's Diaries of the World of Football. But first, let's deal with what happened this weekend. We'll start at the top of the table. We'll move to the bottom to discuss Everton, Norwich, Newcastle and more. But Manchester City end the weekend 11 points clear at the top of the Premier League from Liverpool, by the way, who do have a game in hand. But it was another confident performance and win from City over Chelsea at the top of the table. Kevin De Bruyne with a stunning curling winner. That's the difference in a match in which City really could have scored more. Maybe Chelsea could as well, though. I've got to ask, was this the day that the title was won? Because they don't play Liverpool until the second week in April. There are only six games left after that. What do you think, Alison?
Never has the phrase game in hand meant so little to so many people. It's normally when you've got a game in hand, you get quite excited about a game in hand, don't you? Game in hand could be anything to anybody. Could mean so much. Doesn't feel like it means very much at the moment. Very nice piece by Paul Hurst in the Times this morning saying when City take the lead, it's time to go home. They're so metronomic and it's hard to see where they're going to stumble, fall down. I think Liverpool could play amazingly well and cope with the absence of Salah and Mane beautifully from now on, and it won't make a difference because I don't see what can happen to City. So they were predictably good, and the interesting bit from that game was Chelsea, and I think it's been slightly underplayed how Tuchel spoke afterwards. He seemed to be reigniting this sort of internal spat with Romelu Lukaku. I mean, the ultimate irony at the start of the season was everybody was saying Chelsea could win the title because they've got this amazing, almost £100 million centre forward in the ever-improving Lukaku. And Manchester City failed to get Harry Kane. And you've got the two teams up against each other. And having Lukaku seems to be not helping Chelsea. It doesn't seem to be, seems to be something that they're having to accommodate rather than take them to another level. So that was peculiar. Whereas City don't look like they've got many problems at all. And of course, we always forget how good they are defensively. Manchester City, just very difficult to break down. So if Liverpool were playing City, I don't know, end of Feb, there might be some tension. But as you say, Hugh, that game, it could mean nothing by the time they actually face each other.
We'll come to Romelu Lukaku in more detail in a moment. Just on City, Tom, do you see any way back for anyone else? You know, they might be distracted by other competitions. Give me something.
Well, I'm going to have to, aren't I, Hugh? Because I've said they're going to crack up at some point. So I'm going to, as I've said...
Where will they crack?
I don't know. I think I'm just doing it just to try and drum up some excitement in the title race that is long since over. But I'm sure listeners are also waiting for our producer, John, to clip up those moments when I said City would crack. Maybe he's waiting for win number 20 in the streak. I don't know. Who knows? It certainly doesn't look like it, especially when they make changes like no Diaz, bring in Stones to play with Laporte. And as shamelessly stolen from a fellow journalist on Twitter, last 13 games with Stones and Laporte, 13 wins, 41 goals scored and one conceded. I mean, that's without your supposed best player and talisman. That's absolutely extraordinary. you know, I think Alison makes an interesting point about the Lukaku causing seeming disruption. No Harry Kane, City essentially. Yes, Jack Grealish is a bit of a conversation piece, but essentially the same team as last season. And actually, in this age of multi-million dollar spending all the time, quite refreshing that a team is just relentlessly ploughing on with winning and playing in the same very, as Alison says, ruthless way. I'm going to say that they're going to crack a little because I've said it so many times. And I do think there might be something. Maybe they'll get injuries. Maybe they'll be affected a bit more by COVID, although they've had a few COVID cases recently, haven't they? And it didn't seem to bother them. So, yeah, the Stones-Laporte thing was the most striking thing for me, to make that kind of a change in this kind of a game. And they just absolutely dominated Lukaku and looked so comfortable.
Matt, I've been speaking to my friends that support Chelsea and Liverpool this morning about what the difference is between them and Manchester City. And we've had a few interesting conversations. I mean, I think the main point was not just Manchester City have loads of money, but what they've done with it is basically be excellent in every single department of the club, recruitment, the team on the pitch, the training ground, the infrastructure. Everything seems to have gone right over the past, 5 to 10 years. The first few years weren't essentially great, but what is the difference for you now? Why has what was meant to be a three-horse race turned into a bit of a procession?
Big question, but I mean, the city regime in this era, as you said, I mean, it was being built for Guardiola even before Guardiola arrived. He knew the people he was going to work for. There was a basic stability. I mean, I think we all, you know, he's one big thing that's been disproved was this idea that, you know, he burns up after 3 or 4 years and burns everyone up with him. He's just, this intensity is unsustainable, and City is the place where, you know, this has been disavowed, and that's because of the people he's got around him. He is, you know, served, I mean, he is intense. You speak to anyone at City and they can say he can be an absolute pain in the butt to work for, but he would actually take that as a compliment. He is a pain in the butt because he's such a perfectionist, and he's relentlessly demanding. And the difference at City is that, you know, he makes those demands and people jump, and, you know, within a certain degree of reason, they deliver everything he wants. So, you know, this is just sort of, this is, you know, the sort of snowballing work of not just his time, but a couple of years before he even got there. So, you know, it's a sort of, and we're talking one of the greatest, you know, managers that's ever worked. I mean, you know, there are probably still some people out there carping that, you know, I could do it with this team. I could have done it with Lionel Messi, but I think, you know, there's no doubt that he is one of the most creative coaching minds that we have seen in decades. And yeah, I mean, all of those things add up to an extraordinary benchmark, plus obviously not forgetting the £1 billion team squad that you've got. Trying to keep pace with that is incredibly hard. And that's why, you know, you look at the table and we've seen bigger sort of transformations in a league table than this. You know, if you go back in Premier League history, I remember 97-98, Man U were 11-12 points clear. The bookies were paying out at this time saying, you know, there's no way a team like United blows it. And Arsenal came storming through. United, as you'll know, need no reminding, Hugh, cracked, and complete transformation, really unexpected. But I just don't see that that's going to happen this time. City have got too much going for them. Simple as that. Even if they get a couple of key injuries, then you've sensed that they have the depth to replace them.
It was a brilliant goal to win it from Kevin De Bruyne. Any question marks? I don't want to be too harsh over the goalkeeping here.
He did weirdly move the wrong way. It was just the tiniest movement. I wondered if he did that on purpose to give himself more reach, you know, like a springboard movement. Like, he always meant to go the right way. But if that was the reason, it backfired. Because if he hadn't, maybe he would have reached.
I was at the game, and actually, as Kevin De Bruyne charges forward, You see in your mind, right, he's coming forward, he's building up a head of steam, he's going to smash this, you know, into the back of the net. And he stops. And in that moment that he basically completely, you know, his pace changes completely, he slows down entirely. Everyone in the Chelsea defence goes from thinking shot to pass. Yeah. Thiago Silva thinks, right, there's a pass left, there's a pass right. And he doesn't, if you watch again, Thiago Silva doesn't charge in to block. You know, you think in that situation, great centre-back like him, he's gonna block a shot. Why hasn't he done that? And he's taken a little step back as well, thinking, I have to think about who's going to get the ball played through to them. And I think Kepa does the same. he almost stops thinking, right, this isn't going to be a shot. There's going to be a slide rule pass one way or the other. And he moves to his right in case he has to go that way. Thiago Silva's thinking about going the other. And actually, he ends up a little bit on his heels and he can't reach the shot, which isn't really in the corner. But I didn't blame either of them, no. Which is why I asked.
I think it's interesting. It reminds me a little bit of the Salah goal against Chelsea a few weeks ago when we talked about how he did Marcus Alonso, I think, by... I'm going to go in on my left. Oh, no, it's all right. I'll go down the right. And then with Mendy, I'm going to bend it in the far corner. No, I'm not. I'm going to beat you at your near post. Whether De Bruyne was doing it deliberately or not, or whether he did just take that split-second pause to assess his options and then go, oh, actually, I can just pop it in the bottom corner. But as you say, Hugh, you're spot on, I think. Because for Silva and Kepa, it was that brief moment that De Bruyne took that then made them take that brief step, moment, pause, which gave him the chance.
Belgian brilliance for Manchester City. Not quite the story for Chelsea. Thomas Tuchel saying after the game that Chelsea lacked quality up front. It was a poor day for Romelu Lukaku. What do you think the issue is with him? Maybe in this game? I don't know if you think it's more broad than that. Alison, I'll start with you.
A few weeks back, when Lukaku gate broke, I did say this doesn't feel right because Tuchel had gone to five or six players and made it clear that they also felt his sort of interview he'd given in Italy about how he wanted to go back there one day was, you know, not sanctioned, and he shouldn't have said it, and it undermined his presence at the club. So, but Tuchel didn't do it on his own. He got other players involved. And I did say at the time, when he comes back into the dressing room, what will the atmosphere be like? I mean, they might all put their arms around him and say, oh, great to see you again. But he will surely harbour doubts about how that problem evolved. And now, I mean, it sounds simplistic, but there is a disconnect between him and his teammates. There were various situations where you felt, does he know these people? Why is he not passing to him? That's an obvious pass. Why is he not passing to him? Why is he passing to him? Why is he not choosing to shoot? Is he feeling like he's going to be accused of being selfish if he shoots? We all love Lukaku because he's this powerful, confident centre forward who does shoot perhaps when most people wouldn't and pulls it off often. You know, he's got that strength of character, presence, aura, whatever you want to call it. If he's feeling inhibited because people are criticising his very personality, and that's how he will feel. I mean, it's all very well talking about what the club feels, what Tuchel feels, what his teammates feel, what his former club feels. I mean, it's if you're the expensive star name striker in a team, you have to feel good about yourself. You have to feel everyone buys into what you are. And if he's hesitant about that, I think that's the sort of performance you got against Man City. Yes, of course, Manchester City, as I said earlier, incredibly good defensively. But there always are with City moments because they commit and they hold a high line and so on that you can get at them. But you need to be really confident in yourself and your teammates to do that. And he's not. I don't think he is.
It's a surprise, and that I think I was surprised that Tuchel went sort of front foot and aggressive with Lukaku again. I mean, I think, you know, understand on the back of the interview and the need to show who's boss. But, you know, it's interesting. I remember doing one of the columns with Jose Mourinho last summer, and he was talking about Lukaku and how, you know, he always made the observation, this is a guy who definitely needs that sense of being, you know, his person. Some players can thrive off confrontation. Others need to feel very much, you know, a part of the group and maybe even sort of king of the group. And I think Alisson's right. I think, you know, that disconnect, you know, is being played out on the pitch, and say all the more reason why, yeah, I don't blame Tuchel for being, you know, it's clearly not his fault necessarily that there is that schism in the first place, but it did seem almost a high risk strategy to be trying to solve it by pointing the finger again after this game.
There was a moment, wasn't there? I think it was in the first half with an attempted 1-2 with Hakim Ziyech where Lukaku just completely overhit the pass, and Ziyech did a very almost sort of, oh, don't worry, Rom, you know, don't worry about it, mate, when actually it was a really, really poor ball and a rare chance to get in behind.
He then returned the favour.
Yeah, exactly. But that exactly. And that's interesting. You know, the guys are talking there about managerial arm round the shoulder type with Lukaku. And I think as well, he very much needs that on the pitch with his teammates in terms of the consistency in the playing style. we talked in, you know, some of those quotes about Inter Milan and returning and how much he loved playing with Lautaro Martinez at Inter. And you think back, he did very well at Everton when he had an entire team geared towards him scoring goals. I think there's a bit of that going on at Chelsea as well. We've talked about it before. Though all those players they've got in those positions behind and around Lukaku, Havertz, Pulisic, Ziyech, Hudson-Odoi, Mason Mount, all that, he hasn't formed any kind of bond with them on the pitch, as well as the kind of bond Alisson was talking about in terms of camaraderie. And I think that's a massive part of Lukaku's game. You know, he's not Mo Salah. As much as he can occasionally score a screamer, he's not Mo Salah. He needs the team working for him, and he needs to make consistent partnerships, I think. And that's also what's missing.
I think there needs to be an improvement at Chelsea, I have to say. I think they're good. They're a very, very good team. But there is a gulf between them and Manchester City for me. And I don't know if Thomas Tuchel's going to bridge that gap. We're going to see what happens, I think, with his future. We know what's going to happen when it comes to Rafa Benitez, though. He has been sacked as the Everton boss after less than 7 months in charge. They were beaten 2-1 by Norwich City at the weekend. They've only won one of their last 13 Premier League games. They're 15th in the table, 6 points above the drop. The club say they will update on a permanent replacement in due course. But their board did hold an emergency meeting after that game on Saturday. It was a 9th loss in the past 12 league games. There was a banner, "Get out of our club," which was very strange because the cameras went to it and they sort of put it away. Someone sort of said, hold on a minute, you know, we might come back in this game, not too early. And then it came back out again later on in the game, which was much to the enjoyment of the broadcasters because they finally got a good shot of it. And in the end, those supporters were rewarded, I guess, if you like, with what they hoped, which is that Rafa Benitez left the club. I don't know if this is the right decision, which I know the Everton fans, most football fans will be surprised with. It's a bit of a poison chalice. I don't know who's going to do a much better job. Maybe I'm just naive. What do you think?
Well, first of all, who'd go? I mean, there are people who do a good job, but I don't think they'd go to Everton now. No. Because your reputation's not going to be enhanced, is it? Everyone's saying Benitez was a bad appointment in the first place, as if that means he's off the hook. The reason people say that is because the minute there was an issue or a run of bad form or bad luck, the fans would turn because at best, they were pragmatic about it. I know some very, very passionate Evertonians who absolutely detest Liverpool, but they were prepared to say, "Well, if Rafa can do it, if he can change our fortunes, if he can make us, you know, compete at the highest level, be considered an elite club, then that's fine. We're happy to go with it because we really need it." And the idea is, it was a bad appointment because if he doesn't do that, they're going to turn quicker on a former Liverpool manager than they're going to turn on anyone else. But I would say the reason it was a poor appointment is because the impression I get is that there's quite a lot of player power or player indulgence at Everton. You need the players to be handled. Good managers do that, don't they? I mean, we've just been talking about Pep Guardiola and how he's difficult, people find him difficult and demanding. And even after we've been gushing over Kevin De Bruyne's goal, but he said, oh, he can play better. He's always, always asking for more from the players. If you've got a manager, and Rafa is like this, he's a bit of a micromanager. It's a famous story of him going in at Anfield and changing all the light bulbs personally because he didn't like the wattage. You know, he's somebody who wants to be on top of everything. That makes life difficult for players. If the players know, well, you know, beyond the manager, the board are quite sort of paternalistic and they do have their favourite players. And if you go around the boardroom rooms, you know, the nice new offices they've got on the riverfront there, you know, they have pictures and shirts of players. It's a bit fanboy-ish, right? The vibe is, we love our players. So if you've got a manager, he wants to be strict and the players don't want anyone being strict with them. They know they've got the upper hand because they know that Rafa Benitez is on thin ice. They're not going to buy into a Rafa regime because they know the fans will turn on him. They know they'll be okay. You need a manager that is got this sort of pure background that everybody buys into, that can take real masterful control and be a tough manager to work for, because there's nowhere else for the players to go. The players had an excuse from day one with Rafa Benitez, is what I'm trying to say, because they knew when it came to the crunch, he'd be the one to go, because so many people at the club were like, should we be having the former Liverpool manager here or not? So in that sense, it wasn't about Benitez as a man or a manager. It was just about the impact. He was limited. He could not have a big impact on players who are, I think, a bit indulged.
I mean, it's very strange, the timing of it. He spent, what, 1.7 million in the summer. He'd been given a little bit more funds in January, brought in a few players. Luca Dina had left the club, which was a big one for the fans, of course, and a very talented player to go out the door when you're struggling as well. Benitez saying in his statement, it's only when you're inside that you realise the magnitude of the task. I feel for him on this because, and this is why I think is a bit of a poison chalice, and he alludes to it, the club has been so poorly run, appointing five managers in 5 years, the hierarchy has to take responsibility for that coming to fruition in terms of results. Matt, what do you think?
No, totally. I mean, I've been fascinated by Mashiri ever since way back. A small group of us went to interview Usmanov in Moscow. He flew us out on his private jet, which was the only private jet I've ever been on, I should add. And and there was this guy who came along with it, and he was sort of almost, he was almost sort of our travel guide. He sort of took us onto the plane and took us to Moscow and sort of made sure that we all got there in one piece. And it was only subsequently that this guy, who was revealed to be Mashiri, it all started to make sense. It was a very strange dynamic then, and I find it still obviously a very strange dynamic now. We know about their sort of in this sort of strange intertwining, but he was a sort of mysterious, hard to pin down guy then, and he's become, well, certainly any sensible thought has been harder to pin down at Everton. I think it's been a reign that's been a complete mess. I think he's one of those owners that sort of half interfered, half thinking he knows what he's doing, and that sort of heart, you know, I want to say on this half in, half out sort of approach has complicated things. I know that, you know, people at Everton have been, he likes to get good PR. I know people at Everton have been hugely frustrated that they sort of found out big news via, you know, TalkSport. I know that, you know, because of he's sort of very erratic in the way he handles those communications. I think his appointment, I mean, even the appointment of Carlo Ancelotti, you could say that's, oh, what a coup that was. To be honest, to me, it made no sense at all. It was obvious that someone like Ancelotti, one of the, you know, most successful managers of the last 20, 30 years, was going to jump to a club like Real Madrid at the first opportunity. You know, Everton, with all due respect, is not Real Madrid. And he's just lurched around, isn't it? How can you make appointments that are sort of as far-ranging as Allardyce and Ancelotti? I mean, it just, you know, there's been no strategy to it. We've seen directors of football with no direction. We've seen, yeah, the staffing levels. We've seen schisms in the board about a lot of major appointments. And obviously we've seen an awful lot of money, a hell of a lot of money wasted on, again, on erratic signings. So someone like Benitez comes in and he's got a hodgepodge of a squad that's been bolted, you know, sort of, he's trying to bolt together, that's been appointed by the board by six different coaches. So, you know, I don't think Rafa Benitez can get entirely off the hook, but I think, you know, if I was an Everton fan, I'd be just thinking, you know, where the heck is Mashiri taking us? Because you can't see a direction in any of it.
Yeah, and of course, director of football Marcel Brands went in December, and that was meant to sort of alleviate the anger of the fans, wasn't it? It was like, I can't sack another manager, so Marcel Brands can leave. Yeah, they've wasted a lot of money, not just under Marcel Brands, but the previous director of football as well. That's given them a very disjointed squad, including, of course, overhaul of managers constantly, meaning that the squad then changes. And the people linked with replacing Rafa Benitez, again, it seems like there's this big variety. Graham Potter, the Brighton boss, strongly linked. I wouldn't do it if I was him, but there you go. Former Everton boss Roberto Martinez, who Mashiri first got rid of. And now the Belgian boss, of course, why he would want to come to Everton at this time, World Cup year. Derby boss, Wayne Rooney, you know, once a blue, etc., etc. But Duncan Ferguson on interim till the end of the season. I mean, there's a variety of characters and styles of football.
Absolutely. And it's interesting that you talk about that variety, because I was then thinking about the list of managers before, and you've got Koeman, Allardyce, Marco Silva, Ancelotti, Benitez. And as you say, that's a complete range of styles, personalities, experience, background, different abilities to lure different types of players. And they've all got 10 years of 58 games, 26 games, 60 games, 67 games, 22 games. And I mean, it's just completely mad, really, that that is how the club has been run, with no direction. And it comes back to this point that we've not mentioned it for a while, but it is a big theme on this podcast. What is your club? What is it about? And it's something that we've praised David Moyes for doing at West Ham. You feel like Steven Gerrard is trying to do it at Aston Villa. As you say, Hugh, Brighton have got a clear identity and strategy on and off the pitch under Graham Potter. Everton are way behind these clubs. And yet, if you said that to some fans, they'd be absolutely distraught at that idea.
I know. And obviously, Moyes, you know, when he had his that truncated year at West Ham, you know, he did a good job there and left. And he was available then in all that time. You know, here's a guy who, you know, I think the fans would have welcomed. Obviously did great stuff at Everton. And yeah, just he was spurned then. And, you know, obviously Everton would grab him now, but he's doing good stuff at West Ham instead. And as you mentioned, Potter, I mean, I don't think Potter would leave for that at the moment. Why should he? But he's exactly the type of manager that was sort of was under Everton's noses all this time, but they were, they didn't have anyone sort of smart enough to think of the sort of strategic look they were sort of casting around.
What is so instructive, I think, is that Mashiri's thinking of getting Roberto Martinez, or would like him to come back to the club, because Martinez is one of the nicest people in football. He is lovely company. And I'm sure Mashiri was thinking, I like talking to him. He was I liked him. Yeah, let's have him back, because maybe I shouldn't have got rid of him because he was nice. And Rafa was always asking for things. And Koeman, he was quite scary. I want to go back to someone I liked. I mean, it just does feel indulgent as opposed to properly thought through.
To me, thinking about Everton, there's a slight parallel almost with Manchester United in that the post-Sir Alex Ferguson era, they've been scattergunning and completely lost. And Everton, the post-David Moyes era, who ironically enough went to Manchester United, and they've been doing the same, trying to work out what the hell they are. But the problem when you're Everton as opposed to Manchester United is Manchester United can buy loads of players and still scrap around the European places whilst they're trying to work out what they are and seemingly appoint Ralph Rangnick and become a pressing team with loads of young players and exciting. Everton are now in a relegation scrap. You know, they've got Newcastle and Brentford coming up after they play Villa. So Stevie G sticks one over them. They're in a serious, serious, serious trouble, which is why they then end up going down the routes of like Allardyce and others to get them out of it. And then they have the moment where they go, we're better than this. And they go for Ancelotti, who, as Matt says, jumped ship at this first opportunity. And round and round and round we go. They're in a difficult bind, because if they go for a big project, let's start it all again, you know, as we're saying Manchester United might be doing with Ralph Rangnick, that takes time, and it also takes money that they might not have, and they might find themselves in a proper relegation scrap come kind of April.
And through it all, you've got the giant metaphor of the new stadium. Never has a stadium taken so long to be built. Yeah. And they're only at the point where they're putting concrete in holes. It's absolutely ridiculous. Maybe the moment that stadium is built, that'll be when they are phoenix-like, rising from the ashes of what they have. But there's this, I'm not being entirely silly about that. There is a sense of temporary, there's a temporary feel to Goodison. It's crumbling, and they're not going to do it up because they're going to go to a new stadium, probably. It's like, they're turmoil of their own making. It's like, it's like if you're building your own little, like Matt, I think you've got a loft extension going on at the moment, haven't you? Well, it's like, you know, you've got a loft extension going on, so you're unlikely to sort of decorate the rooms in and around, aren't you? Because you're going to want to finish the big heavy work before you do the little stuff. And Everton feels a bit like that. They're in limbo. They're in limbo.
Don't underestimate my ability to screw my own house up. Yes, there's me and DIY don't go well together. But no, wasn't it? But Mashiri took over and talked about, was it something about making them the Hollywood club of the Northwest or something? Wasn't there some ludicrous poppycock quote about that?
But there always is. There always is with a new owner. Yeah.
Disaster
movie. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. There's no to it.
Well, we have to divert attention, I think, from the loft to the basement, because the bottom of the Premier League table, what? Oh, you see what I did there?
Come on, man. Yeah. That is class. That's link of the year
so far. Thank you. Everton, 19 played, 19 points. Watford also 19 played, 14 points. And then you get into the bottom three. Norwich, 21 played, 13 points. Newcastle, 20 played, and they have 12 points. And then at the bottom now, 17 played, 11 points for Burnley. Everton do risk being dragged into that, you have to say. But after the weekend's results, a 1-1 draw between Newcastle and Watford at St James's Park and Norwich's victory over Everton, it is very tough to call, Tom.
It is. I just can't believe it. I mean, we'd all written Norwich off, worst team in Premier League history. And they're third from bottom. They've only scored 10 goals. Now, this could be one of the greatest escapes of all time if Dean Smith pulls this off, particularly as you watch the other teams and you think they're just not getting better as they should have been. Newcastle, again, I mean, you can sign all the players you want if you keep conceding goals. They've dropped the most points from winning positions in the league, 21, which is three more than Southampton. And you could just see that etched on Eddie Howe's face when that header went in. He's like, oh, for God's sake, lads, not again. But they just look so flimsy and so susceptible to that. Even at St James's Park, you know, this supposed fortress. And it comes back to something that Alison's talked about before with the kind of nerves and the slight idea that everything else is fantastic. And then you're like, oh, crap, the football as well. Forgot about that bit.
It is January, and they probably should have bought a defender by now. So you can't really complain.
Well, no, but you are hearing as well reports that they're going to keep following our suggestion, Hugh, which I think we made when we said they should just copy Burnley and sign Sean Dyche and all their players, and that they're going to go in for James Tarkowski, which wouldn't surprise me.
No.
And would be a pretty big move in the relegation battle, because I think he would be far more significant signing than even Chris Wood. Because that would be a far bigger loss for Burnley. It's just so impossible to call. I mean, I'm genuinely baffled by the idea that Norwich have put themselves in a position with that win where they now could get out of it. I mean, Watford as well just looks so inconsistent. I think you said it recently, Hugh, that they'd almost had their little jump and their little moment probably with that big win at Everton as well. So you can't necessarily see them coming again. I wonder whether it'll be three from those four unless Everton get dragged into it.
Yeah, it's going to be a big, I think, month and next few weeks for some of the clubs at the bottom of the table before things get a little bit more defined as well. And look, when it comes to Watford, you've got to say other teams around them need to take their opportunity while the Africa Cup of Nations is on, because some of their starting 11 are away at the moment. And when they're back, it will be a stronger side. Anyway, loads still to come on the Game Podcast. Remember, if you're enjoying it, rate us, leave us a review. Make sure you're subscribed as well. We'll talk about postponements in the Premier League, and then it's Dicko's Diaries.
The train is now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, Road Station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Well, Tottenham Hotspur say they are extremely surprised at the decision to call off the North London derby against Arsenal at the weekend. Arsenal's request into the Premier League to postpone that game due to a lack of eligible players was granted a little bit over 24 hours before kickoff. The Premier League rules say that clubs can apply for postponement if COVID-19 is a factor in teams having fewer than 13 players and a goalkeeper available. Now, Spurs said in a statement, the original intention of the guidance was to deal with player availability directly affected by COVID cases, resulting in depleted squads that, when taken together with injuries, would result in the club being unable to field a team. They say, we do not believe it was the intent to deal with player availability unrelated to COVID. We now may be seeing the unintended consequences of this rule. It has been reported that Arsenal only have one COVID case. Alison, I know you've written about this weekend. Who's to blame?
Oh, I've written about it deeply sarcastically, actually, because it's I mean, this has to be the point where it changes, surely. It's ludicrous. You have the comparison with Leeds United down, I mean, literally bare bones. There's, you know, there's a 12-year-old on the bench. It's ridiculous, and they put out a team and show that a club is bigger than the first 11 most fans can name. It's about whether you've got a holistic approach, that everyone involved in the club, no matter what age group, they're all working to the same pattern. So you can call upon all these players that you have at your disposal. That's the whole point of being a big club in a big league. You are more than just, you know, the normal team sheet you see. Arsenal seem to take the view that, well, for some reason, they're the only club for whom the Africa Cup of Nations has caused interruption. One of their absentees is because of a red card. That is never an excuse, is it? That's part of the punishment, is you have to field a weakened team. I'm talking about Granit Xhaka, of course. They've got injuries, but none of them are... They're a mixture of long-term, short-term, may or may not be fit sort of players. And Ødegaard, we understand, tested positive, and subsequent to them putting in their application for the game against Spurs to be postponed, one other player seems to have tested positive. And I think the whole of football wanted the panel, which has medics on it apparently, to assess the application and say, well, actually, you know, one, possibly two cases of COVID, your training ground hasn't been closed down. This is not what this emergency assessment procedure is for. It's a bit, you're a bit unlucky, but you can put a team together. You can put a team together. And just look at Leeds. Leeds have got a team together. If Leeds had wanted the game postponed and had one COVID case, you suspect then that would have been cancelled, their game against West Ham. So you can see it's inequitous. It's not right. It's creating, also it's self-defeating, because it's creating a backlog which will in itself cause problems for the clubs and possibly be bad for the players who are being pushed to come back quicker than they should. A backlog means players suffer. So you're going to have this sort of self-perpetuating roller coaster, a situation where you just get more and more injuries because you're pushing the players too much. Player welfare has been a big thing all season, and in the short term, allowing a club to call a game off sounds like you're putting player welfare first, but you're not. You're creating problems down the line. And also, it's the whole thing about postponements is about public health. It's about stopping the spread of a virus. It's not about, oh, you know, you're a big club with a big game and you can't field the team you really would like to. And it feels like an excuse, and you shouldn't be using a pandemic as an excuse. It's... Anyway, the mood is that they're not going to change. This type of postponement where you've got a lot of people out, missing, suspended, whatever, but you've got one or two COVID cases will allow you to get a match postponed. And that just feels deeply immoral, actually.
I mean, I said it a while ago. So all these people saying, you know, why finally when it's Arsenal do you decide to call it out? I mean, you may not have been listening when it was Newcastle, Leicester, Burnley. I mean, about half a dozen clubs in the Premier League have been criticised for their requests. Remember Crystal Palace, we spoke about, their game was actually on after their request was rejected, and it was virtually a full strength team. There have been some clubs trying to use, in my opinion, the Premier League's leniency on this. Too many games, too many requests have been allowed quite clearly. And in my opinion, they've put the broadcasters first. They put the quality of the players on show ahead of the fans, having matches on, and the schedule, which, by the way, all these clubs are constantly complaining about. So we'll see how it works out towards the end of the season. What happens now, though? That's the question, Matt. What do you think?
Well, like Zadison said, I mean, they've said that they're not going to change the actual rules, but you would certainly hope the interpretation of them is stiff. And I don't think, I think you're right. I think there was obviously, you know, this was the worst case, obviously the most high profile case of it. But I like to think that the backlash against it, the fact that pretty much everyone apart from an Arsenal sympathiser is saying enough's enough, that this is taking advantage of a situation rather than what the rule was for. Hopefully that is, you know, shall we say, stiffen the Premier League resolve to not be as soft touch as they ridiculously have in this case. I mean, like I said, if you sign African players, you know, months in advance, they're going to AFCON. If Xhaka's stupid enough to get sent off, then you're going to miss him. Those are not even close to reasons to, in some ways, given what Arsenal have seen around them, you can't blame Arsenal for making the request in a totally self-serving way. But the Premier League's not had great leadership on this issue at all.
We so often take our cue from the Bundesliga in Germany, and there was another good example of this from Bayern Munich. They lost to Borussia Mönchengladbach recently, but they had 9 positive COVID cases, I think. It resulted in them playing a fairly patched-up team, and their bench had a senior goalkeeper, and then the rest was all youth academy players, some players who'd never played for the club before, and they just put out a team and talked about it and got on with it.
Just getting some transfer news in from Fabrizio Romano, so you know, you can take it with a pinch of salt if you want. Here we go. Arsenal have loaned out Pablo Mari to Udinese until the end of the season. Another player they don't need, you know, in their squad at the moment, because it's not like we're getting games called off because we haven't got enough players or anything like that. It's a bit ridiculous.
It is a bit ridiculous. But I mean, the guys have talked about it there. I don't necessarily want to boot Arsenal too much, just because, not because I've been so complimentary of them, but because I think it's the system that's at fault here, and it's the Premier League, and who, by all accounts, in today's paper, Matt Lawton and Gary Jacob writing that they've got no plans to change it or review it in any way whatsoever. So let's crack on with the farce and keep going.
I don't think they think it's a farce. I think they've measured up to negative stories and said that this is the more acceptable negative story for them. Do we want fans up in arms at us because we force teams to play, you know, 16 and 17 year olds just to get games on? Or do we want fans up in arms with us because the game's been called off? But and I think they've chosen this as the lesser of their perceived two evils.
Which is a very strange one, because I think this country, arguably more than any other, are obsessed with young players and young talent. And we love a story about this 15-year-old who burst onto the scene. I mean, Marcus Rashford might not have a career that he's got now and the notoriety that he's got now on the pitch were it not for a host of injuries at Manchester United that allowed him to be thrown in and out of nowhere in a European Cup game, but a European game by Louis van Gaal. So these games provide great stories. You know, Leeds had Archie Gray, 15 years old, related to former Leeds legend, on the bench. You know, they're great things. So I'm not saying that you're wrong, Hugh, but I'm saying that if that is the reason, it's a strange one to go down, because we love watching young players coming through.
Also, I don't know why they think they've got a dilemma, because all you have to do is say, is this fixture a threat to public health? Yes or no? And quite clearly, Arsenal v Spurs was not a threat to public health.
Well, that's not why they've called it off, though. It's nothing to do with public health.
Exactly, but there is no dilemma. They're making a dilemma.
This is about wealth. This is about broadcasters being happy.
Wealth, not health.
This is about the North... Exactly. Well, I didn't go full hog with it, but I think it was implied, you know. Listen, the Premier League has sat back and said the North London derby... You know, it's a, you know, one of the diamonds in our broadcasting crown. Whoever's paid to show it, you know, that gets a lot of viewers. It's the big game in a derby sense, I think, you know, in the Premier League. And we want to see a good show. We don't want Tottenham to roll over Arsenal's under 23s. I mean, that, by the way, is another farce about their rules. Arsenal put in the request, and a couple of hours later, their under 23s are playing a game against West Ham in Premier League 2, it's called now. And I don't, you know, that's perfectly fine, because according to the rules, none of those players are eligible anyway. And I thought that was ridiculous. And the rules, by the way, people keep saying you can't change the rules midway through a season for a variety of arguments. You know, the day before the FA Cup third round, the Premier League adjusted their rules on what a senior player was, so that none of the players that played in the FA Cup, just in case loads of youngsters played in the FA Cup or the Premier League teams, you know, vastly changed their sides, would be eligible for the Premier League. They would not be counted as senior players. Why? Because the FA Cup said, if you don't play, your game will be forfeited. And so no games were called off in the FA Cup. Premier League, we all come back and suddenly... You know, teams like Leicester, having played a game in the FA Cup, they're putting in a request hours later to have their next Premier League game postponed. You know, it's been wholly unnecessary, to be perfectly honest. I don't blame any of the individual clubs for now testing the Premier League on this, because they've been very weak, very lenient on this rule, which, you know, it looked at the time when you saw it, 13 players and a goalkeeper, you know, tough, hard and fast rules. and it's not been applied whatsoever. And I just think it's been silly, to be perfectly honest, not to dwell on it too much. You know, not that it's annoyed me or anything like that. More to come on the Game Podcast. We're going to devote here until the end of the podcast. You know, just wanted to catch up with our old friend Matt Dickinson. Yeah, I didn't get a Christmas text. You know, he didn't wish me Happy New Year. But he's back nonetheless, you know, showing the lack of power I have on this podcast, frankly. Matt, listen, everyone wants to know what you've really been up to. You know, we know you've changed your role slightly at the Times. We still see your features, but what are you up to?
Yeah, well, I'm still involved at the Times. I'm very happy to be so, doing my columns and trying to land some interesting features and interviews and stories behind stories. I'm also on the side actually doing some training to be a psychotherapist. So if you're ever in need of any resources in that respect, let me know. But it's a long road before I'm qualified. But yeah, it's a passion I've got, and I'm really loving it.
What drew you into that path, though, and how's it going?
It was actually, I benefited massively from the process myself. Went in to see a therapist in a bit of a state some years back, 6 or so years ago, and I found it life-changing, to be honest. I didn't realize at the time how little I knew and understood about myself, and it just brought so much more clarity to my self-understanding. It brought a lot more happiness to my life, a sort of healthier way of living. I could evangelize for a long time about this, but yeah, I just thought it was sick. It literally was a life-changing process, and having had the benefit of that, I got a real passion for sort of seeing if I could share that with other people.
You can evangelize about it some more if you want to. I mean, we've given, the floor is yours, Matt.
Well, yeah, I just think it's, you know, self-understanding, I think is, you know, I mean, I wish that actually some of it was even taught to, you know, I've got teenage kids, and I wonder why this is almost not a life skill. You know, I mean, you could argue that, you know, teenagers are far too busy with all the joys of life and running around and so on. But I just think, you know, even if it's as simple as, I know some schools are even looking at it at sort of mindfulness sort of work and that type of just basically understanding how much we're, you know, yanked around by these voices in our head, and how much, you know, we're sort of self-sabotage ourselves in life, and so much of the sort of hurt and pain we feel is self-inflicted. And I just think teaching life skills about that, I mean, say I had to start learning it when I was 45, but I wish, you know, maybe it was going to take a life crisis for me to have that sort of waking up. Maybe other people, but maybe it shouldn't take a crisis. Maybe we should try and share this sort of understanding earlier in life with people.
Still got the Ferrari outside, right?
Well, so yeah, as midlife crisis go, as much as I could afford was a new bike, but but no, I don't want to be too happy clappy about it, because the other thing I should say is, you know, which, you know, is part of the training I'm doing as well, I know it's not, you know, a lot of people find it incredibly daunting to walk into a therapist. They say, look, you know, as humans, we want to avoid all the painful things in life. We, you know, it's a natural human instinct to avert our gaze from that sort of stuff. But I would just say, you know, if people do reach a point, and I do think the conversation around this is changing all the time, you know, and I think that's great in itself, is that, you know, and particularly among men, I mean, you look at the suicide rate among men, and that is clearly related to a male inability to sort of seek help, to feel like, you know, they can show vulnerability. And, you know, if I can be involved in any small way and as part of that conversation and that work, then I would regard it as, you know, as hugely fulfilling.
Matt, I have two questions for you. One is, has your training affected the way you view sports stars, and particularly footballers, who are often called, you know, spoiled, and we're only just starting to talk about player mental health? And I wondered if you thought differently about the pressures they're under. And secondly, do you think your interview style has changed since you started to learn how to be a counsellor?
Oh, good questions. I mean, it's funny. It's one thing quite a few people have said, would I intend to take this work into the sports field? I mean, I'm actually, I wouldn't rule it out, and it's obviously, you know, would bring together two bits of my life that I'm hugely sort of interested in and fascinated in, I would only say that I think a lot of sports people are looking to patch themselves up for the weekend. I mean, ultimately, they want to go out and perform. And obviously, psychotherapy tends to be, doesn't have to be. It doesn't have to be deeper work. It doesn't have to be examining childhood, difficulties or traumas. It can just be, helping people get through the day or get through the week. But I think in, sports psychology is a sort of narrower particular field. It doesn't have to be, but I just get that's my sense. And that, to be honest, if I'm only being slightly facetious, then it's because obviously it's a serious subject, but I could easily end up, imagine, working in the media. I think we know there's plenty of highly strong journalists out there. Every job and every field brings its own strains and pressures, but I only have to look around the press box. And, I know plenty of people in our trade who, seek mental health and I think that's something that's been almost under the carpet for most of my profession. And it's only now, actually, that people are starting to be a bit more open about it and, about time. Also, and your second thing, I hope it has actually sort of changed how I go about the job. I just think understanding people, is part of the reason why I love journalism. There is an overlap between journalism and the work I'm doing in therapy. And I think it's about curiosity in people, understanding what makes people tick, what their motivations are. So I think there's definitely an overlap there. But I would like to hope the two worlds can, there's huge differences, but I do think there's a way that they can complement each other as well.
Let's move back to football a little bit, if we can. One of your pieces last week I wanted to ask you about, football cannot be an inclusive environment for gay men when the World Cup is in Qatar. And there's going to be more, I think, comments about Qatar and some of the human rights abuses, some of the laws, which are very different to most of the world, let's call it that, over the next, 10, 11 months. Why did you choose to write this article at this time?
It's something we've actually been talking about for a little while, a sort of piece around that. And it started off actually in the premise of talking about our sort of fixation. And it becomes a bit of a salacious fixation or a sort of headline-y fixation about the gay footballer. Who is he? Come out, reveal yourself, And talking with a couple of guys who work at the Times, a few other, these conversations don't have to be with gay guys, but obviously they're, hugely invested in this issue. And they talked about why. There's one comment in particular that just someone said about the fact that as a gay guy, they felt an English football ground was still the place of all the places they visit in their life that they feel most wary, maybe even scared sometimes, maybe just that they feel intimidated. It might be a specific chant or comment, or it might just be a sense of, this is a very overtly macho world, and they can be sort of made to feel outsiders. And that this was expressed two or three times to me and by people. And I just thought I would look into it. And then obviously going into 2022, we have the Qatar World Cup looming. And there's a zillion reasons why I think that's such an absurd decision. And then I saw Tom Daley did an alternative Christmas message speech in which he actually wrapped the two things together, talked about why it's a disgrace that the World Cup's going to Qatar, where, LGBT community are breaking the law, and how can football claim to be the sport for all and take its prize possession there, which is a great question. And he also then talked about, he would love to see a gay footballer come out in 2022. And I sort of felt like, Tom Daley's he's a national treasure. He's been just fantastic to watch as a diver and a spokesman. But even he was slightly falling into that trap of singling out the player. And I think we need to look at the wider community, the wider issue in football. The rent boy chants that have now been clarified. That's become a hate crime if you chant it. But I mean, why have we been waiting that long to make that conclusion, and what the hell are we doing if people are still singing that chant in the first place?
It's an interesting article, really well written once again from Matt Dickinson, so check it out on the Times app right now. Now, before we go, it's time for Dickinson's Diary.
Blimey, I'm under pressure here.
I just wanted to know from you what you've been noting in the world of football while we haven't been speaking to you each and every week. What's caught your eye?
Well, if I could start with one, just completely self-indulgent, but I think it was huge news at the same time in that Cambridge United, a club I grew up with as a lad and followed up and down the country, to win at Newcastle, obviously was just the humdinger of a result in so many ways, obviously with the deepening the Newcastle crisis. But it had particular resonance for me as a guy who in 1984, April, watched Cambridge United beat Newcastle, Kevin Keegan and all. But this, the reason why that win, it may have been my happiest day ever watching football, was that Cambridge had been on a 31-game the games without a win. We were relegated. We were a mess. Newcastle were going up. They had Keegan, Beardsley. They had this amazing team. Newcastle were given the whole of a stand. They were it's a promotion party, and Cambridge won with a scrappy penalty. Mm-hmm. And it's just, you know, those days where you just football seems like it takes you to somewhere that you didn't dream was possible. So to sort of have all those memories revived by the mighty U's, mm-hmm. which is a club run by some really good people these days, I just thought lifted my spirits no end.
Home to Luton Town next round?
Yeah, it's
easy.
Yeah, I mean, Cambridge have done under the much maligned John Beck, got released the quarterfinals twice in a row as even as a lower league club. So maybe there's more old memories about to be stirred as well.
What else have you been noticing then?
I was fascinated by someone who's I've obviously dealt a lot with Gary Neville through the years, helped him write his autobiography, name drop. But I thought the conversation he's been having, you know, wading into politics and even this discussion about whether he could become, you know, could he become a mayor of Manchester? I just find it fascinating. I mean, we're so used to footballers being, you know, for so long sort of belittled, I think, intellectually regarded as sort of, you know, stick to sport, stick to football sort of argument. And, you know, obviously, I think we've seen that change with you know, one of the small good things about social media is that, you know, it's allowed certainly players to wade in on all sorts of different social issues. But the idea of a player actually becoming a sort of prominent political figure, I think, is absolutely fascinating. Of all that could try it, I think Gary's, you know, in a small group. But the thing about him is I don't put it past him to try. I just think he's one of these guys, as we know, gets out of bed at 5 a.m. and, you know, wants to attack the world and thinks, you know, he will not stop attacking the world till he collapses at the end of the day. I mean, there's no one I've ever met in any walk of life who is more driven, works harder, backs himself. I just find that a fascinating debate to see if he follows through on it.
That was a party political broadcast brought to you by the Labour Party.
By his future director of communications.
No, it would be interesting though, wouldn't it, Tom? I think the Red Half of Manchester would all go and vote for him. Got to show that club loyalty.
Well, absolutely. Manchester, they've got a scouser in charge in Andy Burnham at the minute, so I think Gary Neville afterwards would be a fitting replacement. I mean,
I can guarantee there'll be no garden parties when we're in charge.
Absolutely. I mean, it's an interesting one, isn't it? Because on the flip side, you have conversations which are fair and merited towards players like Marcus Rashford, who's obviously done a great deal of brilliant, brilliant work off the pitch, but he's done so while still playing the game, and questions being asked about. Only recently, Paul Hurst wrote an excellent piece last week about his difficulties on the pitch, contrasting all those brilliant things he's done off the pitch as well. So it's interesting that, yes, Gary Neville is this supercharged high achiever, but he's doing it now whilst off the pitch. I mean, Matt, was he always like that when he was a player as well?
I think he was so monastic as a player. I mean, you know, he literally decided aged, you know, 19 that hanging out with the mates he had was going to be at the detriment of his career, and he cut his mates off. I mean, that's how, you know, you could argue that both ways, that sort of ruthless, or it's just bloody, you know, it's incredibly sensible. He felt he had to be that unbelievably dedicated to make it. He didn't feel naturally gifted like Paul Scholes. And so he, you know, he's just someone who sets his mind on something and then does it 1,000%. And, you know, I think he's acknowledged that. I think he's said that he can't just dabble in politics. You know, so whether he's got space in his life, given he's got a university property empire, Salford City Football Club, etc. But I think the worst thing for him to do would be to do it sort of half cock. I think, you know, if you want to, you know, you're ultimately serving, you know, the people you want, hope to represent. You can't afford to be seen to be toying at it. So that's probably the biggest question over it, is there the space in his life to do it justice?
Didn't stop him dabbling in management half-heartedly, though, did it?
Well, there we go.
We've got Jamie Carragher spokesman now. Honest to God, what are you two like?
I think that is a really good lesson, though, isn't it? He took the, you know, there was this the club owned by Peter Lim, and probably I think there was a, shall we say, blurring of common sense there, that, you know, there's no way he could just swan in. He's, you know, he didn't speak the language, taking it that was half cocked completely, and it blew up. So I think that is, you know, a life lesson in that you can't take on too much.
Yeah, he would be massively refreshing, wouldn't he, Gary Neville? The first politician who actually does support the club that they say they support and also knows something about football, you know? He won't be messing up who he supports in press conferences, etc., etc. Matt, it's been fantastic to catch up. Hopefully we'll see you again soon on the Game podcast. Thank you for telling us all of that, and good luck with it as well. Alison Rudd, Tom Clark, thank you too for being with me, and to all of you for listening. Remember, you can read more of our award-winning journalism at thetimes.co.uk/thegame. If you sign up today, you will get yourself 1 month free. We will see you on Thursday. Take care.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.